I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is writer Andrew Nagorski, the former Newsweek bureau chief who's the author of the fascinating book, Hitlerland. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish experts on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The cover article of Time magazine a week or so ago was about the idea of heaven. You know, does anyone still read Time magazine? There was a time, no pun intended, when the lead story in Time was the most relevant and interesting thing going on in society, and everybody kind of knew it. Way back in 1966, they ran a famous cover asking, "Is God dead?" Also an April issue of Time, by the way, and it became the subject of tremendous discussion and debate for years afterwards, echoed by the New York Times and showing up in the still-popular song Leave On by Elton John, among other places. Anyway, at the time, it was part of a public debate on Nietzsche's contention that God was dead, and everyone knew about it and talked about it and argued about it. Well, it's certainly less true today that any Time magazine cover article has impact. I suspect that the lead on Yahoo or Google's news feeds draws far more attention, and certainly far more immediate attention. But this topic struck me. What do we think of heaven? And just how important is this question in our society today? In general, this is much more of a Christian issue than it is a Jewish one. For many, perhaps most believing Christians, the reward for whatever we do right in this world, especially in belief, comes in the next world, a better afterlife. Judaism has long held that what we do in this world matters much more than whatever might happen to us in the world to come. Often people will tell you that we Jews don't even really believe in heaven. That view reflects a definite bias our tradition has towards focusing on ethics in the only world we have any ability to influence or transform, that is, this one. In fact, the Talmud says those who don't believe in the world to come have no share in it, which seems eminently fair to me. But it wouldn't be accurate to say that Jews don't have heaven. In fact, while the Torah says nothing about life after death, and the rest of the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, is pretty darn cagey about what exactly happens after we die, most of what Christianity came to believe about the afterlife is actually based on Jewish teachings, both in the Bible and in other sources. And many, if not most, Orthodox Jews, and even a goodly number of us non-Orthodox Jews, have a pretty strong belief in the existence of heaven in some form or another. Of course, that means there's no obligation in Judaism to believe in life after death or heaven, but most of us Jews do believe that something important happens after we die, that our essential quality, which we often call a soul, continues after we are biologically gone. The question of whether heaven is an actual place, with or without harps and wings and clouds, is certainly debated, even among Orthodox authorities. But the concept that something intrinsic in our personality will continue and connect with the holiness that we define as God, well, that's something most liberal Jews actually do believe. And that continuity, that place in the hereafter, we might call heaven. You know, the best part of talking about heaven is that no one can prove you are wrong, at least not in this lifetime. But to play us in on this heavenly theme on Too Jewish, this is one of our favorite tracks, Shalom Aleichem, as sung by the Sephardic Brazilian singer Fortuna. Peace to you, you ministering angels, from the Shabbat hymn, Shalom Aleichem.
Shalom Aleichem, Malachei Yesharim, Malachei Elyon, Yinim Melech, Malachei Malachim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Bochem l'shalom, malachei shalom, malachei elyon, imelech, malachei.
That was Fortuna's heavenly version of Shalom Aleichem, peace to you, ministering angels. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll meet our guest, author Andrew Nagorsky, the well-known Newsweek bureau chief who's written a fascinating new book, Hitlerland, about Americans in Nazi Germany before World War II. Find out which American woman saved Hitler's life long before he came to power and changed all history when we return on Two Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. People sometimes ask me if I ever go to other restaurants and try their pizza. The answer is definitely yes. In fact, the other day I went to another restaurant to sample their pizza. So how did it compare to Mama's? Well, first of all, the crust tasted sweet. By that I mean they added extra sugar to the dough. At Mama's, we don't add extra sugar to any of our food. The blend of fresh, natural ingredients we use makes our food taste, well, fresh and natural. Now, there's one more thing I noticed about the other pizza. Based on the portion size and price, I paid about 1.5 times more for it than one of ours. In this economy, that's a pretty big deal. So I guess one reason I try other restaurants is that it makes me realize Mama's Pizza is one of the best. And that's a very sweet feeling. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Check them out at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Andrew Nagorsky. He's the author of Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. Andrew spent many years at Newsweek, in a variety of locations around the world, and currently is the Director of Public Policy at the East-West Institute, a New York-based international affairs think tank. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
All right, so now you have to tell us, why do we need another book about Hitler?
Yes, well, that's funny you should ask that. But in all seriousness, yeah, I mean, we're all, I think, endlessly fascinated by that era and what happened and try to somehow get our minds around the dynamic of it, and you never come up with a totally satisfying answer. And since I was based in Germany twice for Newsweek, once in Bonn and still in the Cold War days, and then in Berlin in the 90s, I certainly went around that question many times. And And I would never attempt to do just another Hitler biography or a sort of a rise and fall of the Third Reich. But it occurred to me, particularly watching the recent books on Americans in Paris, Americans in London, there's never been a book that really tries to encompass the American experience in Germany during the 20s and 30s. And it was such a magnet for Americans there for all sorts of reasons, which we can get into at the moment.
Sure.
And also, once I started looking for material, published, unpublished, diaries, memoirs, correspondence, and began to dig up a huge wealth of this stuff, I realized it was as if I was reliving that period, but without the benefit of hindsight. So what Hitlerland tries to do is put the reader in the shoes of these Americans, diplomats, journalists, artists, writers, anyone who happened to be there, and say, okay, what did they see? What did they understand? What did they misunderstand? And then, of course, that raised for me the question, if I had been there, basically been my predecessor as a foreign correspondent in the 20s and 30s, would I have been more perceptive, less perceptive? And I think all that raises questions about, you know, events which seem perfectly obvious when we look back at them with the benefit of hindsight, no longer seem quite as obvious when you put yourself in the shoes of the people who witnessed them firsthand.
You know, it is a really gripping story, and there are some fascinating aspects to it, some really surprising Americans. The woman who basically saved, I'm not sure I can pronounce her name properly.
Helen Hamstengel, yeah.
Hamstengel, who basically prevented Hitler from committing suicide after the beer hall putsch failed in 1923.
But, yeah.
Talk about changing history.
Yeah, I mean, we can't be 100% sure he would have pulled the trigger, but just to give your listeners the context, here is an American woman, born and bred New Yorker. She came from a German immigrant family, but her parents had come over, and she marries Putzi Hamstengel, whose father is from Bavaria, but whose mother is from a very prominent Bostonian family. He goes to Harvard, class of 1909, along with people like Teddy Roosevelt Jr., actually gets invited to the White House. But in the 20s, when they get married, they come back, they come to Munich, she for the first time, and become good friends with Hitler. And Putzi becomes his propagandist. And there is this moment after the failed beer hall putsch in 1923 when Hitler is trying to elude capture by the authorities. He shows up in her house, and when the police are surrounding the house, at that point, suddenly, she finds him with a gun, and she's convinced that he's about to shoot himself, and she talks him out of it and actually takes the gun physically away from him. You know, it's staggering to think what the history of the last century would have been like, and how all of our lives would have been different, and of course, how many more people would have survived if he had carried through on that, if he intended to, and if this American woman had not intervened.
We will talk much more with Andrew Nagorski. His book, Hitlerland, is just fascinating. Maybe we did need another book about Hitler. When we come back,
I'm glad I'm getting you to that point.
You are. You're convincing me. And the book did,
okay,
too.
Okay.
We'll hear a great deal more about it when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome back our occasionally resident poet, Marty Cohen. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You've been in the Zohar study group for a little while. Talk about how that's influenced you in this next piece.
Starting about 4 years ago, when I began the classes over at Temple Emmanuel, I was primarily interested in studying a greater depth in Judaism, learning different ways of expressing scripture, interpreting scripture. At the same time, I was also engrossed in studies in astronomy and cosmology over at the university. And one way I have found that strengthens the learning process is putting the two subjects down in writing.
Well, let's hear what you have to say about Zohar and cosmology.
This is entitled Eclipse. I fear the darkness because I cannot see. With light, I am witness to all about me. At night, reflected light of the moon, though not as bright as my protection. It is dimmer, but nevertheless, allowing my witness to God's holiness. Protection from evil that lurks in the dark, portentous shadows or land so stark. Perchance I'm in error. The foretelling may rather be for the good. My praying and studies of Torah will my fears allay what comes on the morrow at the break of day. Flow of the light from sun to earth will be broken. Into darkness daylight will unnaturally be thrown. Now fully awake I peer at the sun full of glare, again beholding the naked dance so high in the air. Awesomely I stare upon the celestial communion, the corona, the crown so glacial, radiating outward from the palate into a starlit sky as in a ballet, transmitted by the heavenly betrothed. Beads of light, a diamond ring now showed round the moon. Amidst the shimmering light bathing the earth, I prayed with all my might. Shekinah now filled with warmth overflowing, let me bear witness to sun and moon mating. Totally completed, the moon thus retired, away from the sun, renewed, balance restored. The earth is again awash in the warm flowing waters. This is God's gift to all of his sons and daughters.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you, Rabbi.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach, a happy Yom HaTzmaut, happy Independence Day for Israel.
Chag Sameach, Yom HaTzmaut Sameach. It's a great time of the year. We celebrate Israel. We celebrate independence of Israel. This year, we will have the Israel Festival coming up to us on May 6th from 1 o'clock to 6 o'clock. You are all invited to join us in a free and open for all celebration. The theme of the festival this year will be celebrating Jerusalem together. I think Jerusalem is kind of a symbol of Israel, the connection of the Jewish people to Israel, as well as Christians, Muslims, and people worldwide. So that's a great opportunity for us. It's also 45 years for the liberation of Jerusalem. So that's a great opportunity for us to celebrate and have fun. This year we have some new elements in the festival. We will start the festival at 1 o'clock with a crazy fun pool party, Tel Aviv-style pool party. And I know Tel Aviv is not in Jerusalem, but, well, a pool party is kind of Jerusalem. They don't have the ocean.
It's a sort of an Epcot version of Israel, you know, all in one small, tight place at the JCC.
Exactly. Later on, we will dance a little bit with a Zumba party and some Israeli dancing. We'll have a lot of bouncing castles from all kinds of stuff. Also, this year, for the first time, we're utilizing the entire second floor of the JCC. We'll have an amazing art exhibit done by THA students alongside with Israeli artists that were brought to Tucson by the TIPS partnership. And made amazing artworks, mosaics and paintings and other stuff focused on their connection to Israel. We will have Young Jewish Tucson Bedouin Tent Cafe on the second floor.
Without the hookahs, I think.
Yeah, and it will be iced coffee and not bedroom coffee, but we'll have fun there.
It'll work.
We will also have at the library on the second floor for the first time ever a festival university with speakers offering free and open talks and discussions with dynamic topics about Israel, about Jerusalem, about the conflict, about other elements that refer to Jerusalem and Israel. You're all welcome. We will also have, we have more and more and more, we will also have Tina's Jerusalem Bakery on the second floor where kids can come, make and take their own stuff. We will have great food for purchase and a lot of other fun events. Our main performance will start around 4 o'clock after the THA parade and will be sponsored by the Jewish Federation campaign as kind of a thank you for the community for supporting the Jewish Federation. And we'll have a lot of fun. Come, join us, celebrate, have the great time of your life.
And definitely buy a falafel.
Thanks, so May 6th.
May 6th.
1 o'clock until 6.
1 till 6. Thanks, Guy, and Yom Ha'atzmaut Sameach.
Yom Ha'atzmaut Sameach.
We'll talk next week. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, last week was Yom Ha'atzmaut, Israeli Independence Day. You're just back from Israel. Let's talk a little bit about an aspect of Israeli society that is not well understood here.
Well, I've got a couple aspects for you.
Good.
First of all, you and some of your listeners know that for a few months I've been working on setting up a not-for-profit devoted to promoting tolerance, combating intolerance and prejudice, producing little educational videos that parents and teachers can use all over the world on specific aspects of tolerance and intolerance. So my antennae have been raised to all sorts of tolerance, intolerance, prejudice issues. And one of the things that struck me during this visit to Israel, I was only there for a week, but there are so many fault lines and so many groups that are potentially violent enemies. And I'll give you a couple examples that people don't necessarily think about all the time. Christian Arabs versus Muslim Arabs. Arabs versus Jews, kind of an obvious one. Haredim, sort of ultra-Orthodox Jews versus modern Orthodox Jews. Altogether, religious Jews versus secular Jews. People who complain about the power of the rabbanut and the rabbinate and its ability to interfere with everything, and people who think that the rabbinate should have even more power. Jews who originate in so-called Eastern countries, which mainly means Muslim countries, and Jews who originate in so-called Western countries, which mainly means Christian countries, and on and on. But one of the things that surprised me was every country has a certain population of gays, including Israel. And I had no idea that Tel Aviv has become one of the gay capitals of the world. It attracts tourists. It has a major gay pride parade. At least Tel Aviv, if not Israel as a whole, has proven to be surprisingly tolerant of gays so that gay couples can walk hand in hand and not fear being called names or being the subject of stone throwings or whatever. And I found that, you know, in some ways, we always pay attention to examples of hostility, tension, even hatred, even sometimes violence between subgroups of the Israeli population. But what's much more remarkable is how on a daily basis, they make Israel work. They do tolerate each other. There's a certain degree of live and let live. And of course, it's far from perfect. And one of the things that we can perhaps talk about next week is, you know, the famous wall or the fence.
Separation fence.
Right. I mean, I happened to choose a route from the airport to Jerusalem that went through Modi'in. And you were confronted with the wall and several checkpoints at various points and no exit from this point onward, and a lot of kind of authoritarian, scary signs that reminded you of other countries and other periods. And there's a question, obviously, of whether good fences make good neighbors or whether this is a scar on the soul of Israel. But we can talk about that next week. The overwhelming impression I had was how miraculous it is that this tiny country, in terms of space, has so many groups that could spend all their time stabbing each other, and in fact, generally, do a pretty good job of making things work.
Yeah, it's got to be one of the most diverse countries in the world, and I think it's very strange to hear this, but certainly I think Israel is also one of the most tolerant places in the world.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. One Friday morning, a letter dropped into Rabbi Bloom's mailbox. He opened it and took out a single sheet of paper. On it was written just one word, schmuck. The next day, at the end of his sermon, Rabbi Bloom announced to his congregation, "I have previously come across people who have written to me but forgot to sign the letter, but this week I received a letter from someone who forgot to write it, but signed it." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Habits are often considered to be problems in our lives. Most of us work hard to change or even expunge the bad habits that plague us. Eating too much, working too hard, procrastinating, wasting time on Facebook, watching reality TV. But some habits are actually good things, and cultivating good habits is at least as important as resisting bad habits. This week, we read the Torah portion of Emor, which includes passages that celebrate all the festivals of the Jewish year, and there are many. Last week's portion of Kedoshim focused on the holiness of truly ethical conduct. In Emor, we move to the ways that rituals create habits of holiness in our lives, in particular by setting aside times and seasons for sacredness and dedicating these times to God. In a conservative or Orthodox congregation, Emor is one of the most frequently read Torah portions of all, because it is chanted both when it falls in the normal reading cycle and again on each of the festivals in turn. That is, we would read Emor this week, but also on the various festivals, Sukkot in the fall, Pesach in the spring, Shavuot in the summer. Surprisingly, repetition is considered a sign of additional sacredness. In most areas of our lives, those things that happen rarely are considered to be more important. Graduation, a wedding, vacations, they're exceptional because of their rarity. But, contralogically in Judaism, those rituals which are observed most frequently are considered to be superior in holiness to those that occur less frequently. The more you do something or read something ritually, the holier it becomes. The things we do the most are the most important. Or ought to be, as Judaism thinks. The implied lesson is that our actions must reflect our values. We ought to spend our time doing what matters most. It is by doing this that we will create sacredness. Which means that the process of remembering and celebrating festivals, but particularly the most frequent festival of all, the Sabbath, Shabbat, is especially important. When we connect to these emblems of our religious tradition, when we embrace the rituals and special celebrations of them, we come to own that which can be sacred in our own lives. We create these habits of holiness, which gradually change our lives for the better. And we learn in Emor that we can do this daily, or at least weekly, by finding ways to regularly and meaningfully observe the Sabbath, each and every week. A good habit which serves to make us good. On this week of the Torah portion of Emor, may we each find a way to embrace holiness so that it becomes a habit. When we come back on Too Jewish, which I hope is your habit, our guest Andrew Nagorski will explore what drew Americans to Berlin when the Nazis were rising to power and how we responded to Hitler when we saw him firsthand. It will surprise and shock you. When we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing.
Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Egypt's state-owned natural gas company said last week it was ending a deal to ship gas to Israel because of a payment dispute. Israeli officials responded by warning that the termination cast a shadow over the bilateral peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. The gas deal, signed in 2005, has become a target in Cairo for the broader resentment of the supportive relationship with Israel that was forged by Hosni Mubarak, the former Egyptian president. Lawsuits and criminal investigations have accused Mubarak and his cronies of corruption for depriving Egypt of a fair market price for the natural gas sold Israel. And since Mubarak's ouster last year, unknown attackers have bombed the gas pipeline in the Egyptian Sinai more than a dozen times, obviously to disrupt the flow to Israel. For Israel, the deal has given it a crucial source of fuel. Before the disruptions, Egypt was said to have provided Israel's electric utilities with 40% of their natural gas, which makes up about a third of the total fuel used. The Israeli Foreign Ministry has described the agreement as an important and central element of the bilateral economic relationship. Mohammed Shoaib, the head of the state-owned Egyptian natural gas holding company, said it was exercising a legal right to terminate the contract because its Israeli customers had not paid for the gas for 4 months. Some Israeli officials expressed concern over the suspension of the gas deal. In a statement, Yuval Steinitz, the finance minister, said it was a dangerous precedent overshadowing the peace agreements between Israel and Egypt. Other Israeli officials have played down the potential economic impact, alluding to recent huge discoveries of natural gas off the coast of Israel. The Minister of Energy, Uzi Landau, said that Israel has been preparing for 2 years for the possibility of a cut in gas supplies from Egypt. "We are working to strengthen our energy independence," he said. Egypt's current military rulers and the Islamists who now lead the parliament have pledged to uphold all international obligations, including the peace treaty with Israel. But since Mubarak's ouster, American diplomats and Israeli officials have been bracing for a tempestuous period in Egyptian-Israeli relations. Looks like it might be here. In the recent parliamentary elections and the presidential campaign, Egyptians have been debating how they relate to Israel publicly for the first time. Almost nobody is calling for a cancellation of the Israel-Egypt treaty. All three remaining Egyptian frontrunners for president have pledged to respect it. But nearly every candidate at every level has pledged to take a hard look at the fairness and appropriateness of the unpopular natural gas deal. In other news from the Middle East neighborhood, a senior Hamas official in Gaza said last week that the territory's terrorist rulers intend to begin teaching Hebrew to high school students beginning next year. Ziad Thabet, the Education Ministry Undersecretary, said that the Hamas government is trying to find and train teachers in Gaza to teach Hebrew. He says students should be introduced to as many languages as possible. Hebrew, the main language spoken by Israelis, of course, is now only offered as a university course in Gaza. Thabet says the Gaza government still needs to approve the decision. Many Palestinians see Hebrew as the language of the enemy. However, Hebrew used to be widely spoken in Gaza, particularly by all of those who worked in Israel until a decade ago, which was, frankly, just about everybody. We'll see if speaking Hebrew helps or hurts the relationship, if that's still possible. Last week, American Jewish billionaire Nicholas Berggruen purchased the controlling interest in Burger King. Berggruen invested $1.4 billion in Burger King. He's considered the second largest fast food chain in the world, and Berggruen is reportedly planning to take the company public via the New York Stock Exchange. No word on whether he's going to suddenly make it kosher. Somehow I doubt it. Formed in the U.S. in the 1950s, Burger King has 12,000 restaurants in 70 countries worldwide. I use the word restaurant loosely. Alongside Berggruen's business ventures and private equity holdings, he is also the world's largest private collector of Picassos. One of his current Israeli ventures includes the construction of the Meyer Tower in Tel Aviv, expected to be the most expensive residential building in Israel. Burger King and the most expensive residence in Israel. Who knew? Every now and then, Israel reminds you of its socialist roots. Last week was one such time. Israel's cabinet last week approved a plan to break up some of the country's largest conglomerates, aiming to increase competition and bring down prices after protests over the cost of living last summer. Israel has one of the highest concentrations of corporate power in the developed world. The government estimates that the country's 10 largest business groups control 41% of the market value of public companies. The government's decision today is another step in lowering the cost of living, Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said. He told the cabinet that getting rid of cartels and monopolies would increase competition, which is fascinating because when Bibi was prime minister the first time, he allowed those cartels to form. Anyway, conglomerates will have to choose between owning major financial and non-financial companies. Holding companies structured like pyramids will have to limit how many tiers of subsidiaries they have. Companies will have 4 years to comply with the new rules. Protesters say Israel's conglomerates are partly to blame for driving up the prices of basic goods. Protests will resume in the coming weeks. According to the recommendations, companies cannot hold a financial firm with assets above $11 billion at the same time they have a non-financial company of more than $2 billion in revenue. Sometimes, apparently in Israel, bigger will not be better. And in Waco, Texas, liberal business tycoon. And doesn't that sound like an oxymoron? Liberal business tycoon in Texas? Anyway, Bernard Rappaport died at the age of 94. The son of Jewish-Russian immigrants of left-leaning politics, his father was sent to Siberia in 1905 for Marxist agitation. Rappaport was the founder of the American Life Insurance Company. He eventually sold it for over $500 million in the 1990s. As a student at the University of Texas, Rappaport was inspired by left-leaning professors of economics, and his thinking later evolved into a kind of New Deal capitalism. Rappaport married Audrey Newman after graduating from Texas. They celebrated a 70th wedding anniversary. In 1951, Rappaport borrowed $25,000 and founded the American Income Life Insurance Company, which marketed itself to labor unions. He was a huge supporter of Democratic candidates, had a close friendship with both Bill and Hillary Clinton. He gave millions to the University of Texas for scholarships and endowed many chairs and professorships focusing on human rights and ethics. And he was a major supporter of the Reform Movement's headquarters in Jerusalem, Merkaz Shimshon, which I'll be visiting in a few weeks, by the way. Rappaport supported liberal publications like The Nation and The Texas Observer. Great story about him. The founding editor of The Observer recalls visiting Bernie Rappaport in Waco in 1955 to discuss Rappaport buying advertising for his insurance company. The editor opened the conversation by stating that since life insurance is based largely on actuarial tables, there was no need for commercial competition and it ought to be nationalized. Rappaport startled him by saying, "I agree with you." And then he went on to buy ads for decades. A unique man and a really good guy. May he rest in peace and may his memory be a blessing. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish Andrew Nagorski. He's the author of Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power, an award-winning journalist. He's vice president and director of public policy at the East-West Institute, New York-based international affairs think tank. You may know his name from his long career at Newsweek. He was a magazine's bureau chief in Hong Kong, Moscow, Rome, Bonn, Warsaw, and Berlin. He's written four other books and writes, for pretty much everybody. In researching Hitlerland, I think what was fascinating to me in reading the book was how many prominent Americans seemed to pass through Berlin let alone the pretty large number that actually lived there for a while. Why specifically Berlin? Why in the 20s and early 30s?
Well, what happened was after World War I, as we know, there was this migration. A lot of Americans who had...
The lost generation.
The lost generation attracted, of course, to Paris. And we think about all those. We all love movies like Midnight in Paris, right?
Which, right. Hemingway and Fitzgerald.
Hemingway, Fitzgerald, all of that.
Gertrude Stein, the whole deal, right?
Yes. But what we tend to forget because of what happens next, when Hitler comes to power and it becomes a very different place, that the really cultural center of Europe, despite the fact that Germany had lost the war, was impoverished, there was hyperinflation, but the most dynamic cultural center was Germany, and particularly Berlin. It was a wild scene. There were likes of course, Bertolt Brecht and Marlene Dietrich, George Gross, the great painter. Some of these Americans write in their journals being at a party and where Albert Einstein sort of just wanders in. this was a huge magnet. The other thing about Germany in the 20s was that the Americans were extremely popular there. This was the beginning of what you called Americanization. Sometimes we call it globalization today. Hollywood movies, mass production, in the sense that the Americans also were not vindictive victors. They had been in World War I, but only towards the end, and they were not, from the German point of view, the greatest thing they had going for them. They were not the French, who were seen as vengeful, as trying to keep the Germans down, not allowing them to rebuild, demanding reparations. The Americans were actually often trying to help the Germans and feeling sympathy for them. So all these things together, jazz, movies, everything, made it feel like a very welcoming place. And also, the Americans were in a situation where they were attracted to the fact that life was cheap for them. The sexual mores were absolutely wild. This was a time we all have heard of Josephine Baker dancing in Paris, but she also came in 1925 to Berlin and put on a show, an all-black show. And even though outside there were Nazi protesters already, inside the German audiences loved her. She was a big star. She was showered with gifts and invited to all the after parties where she often danced in her loincloth. So it was a place where it had everyone felt, wow, this is the place to be.
Some of the most famous names in American journalism spent time as correspondents there. Talk a little bit about sort of their experience. Everybody from people like Howard K. Smith to Richard Helms, who later headed the CIA, H.V. Kaltenborn, all kinds of folks were there reporting. How was that experience surprising to you when you started to research through it?
Well, first of all, as you say, some of the people who arrived there as very young reporters first are sometimes just right out of college, like Howard K. Smith, who would later on become a TV star and a TV anchorman, came to Berlin and really made their careers there. Of course, later William Shirer and others, Dorothy Thompson. These were all major figures, and they were going after the big story of the time. And one of the most fascinating things I found in researching Hitlerland is not just what they wrote officially or broadcast, but sometimes their internal letters, their memos to their editors, and the sense of they're trying to figure out what happened here. And Howard K. Smith has this wonderful description of once the Nazis come in power, of how Americans coming over often were awed initially just by, Germany seems like a so well-disciplined, inviting place. The villages along the Rhine are beautiful and so forth. And then suddenly noticing all the uniforms out there, and at first almost being thrilled by the kind of the martial spirit of the place, rebuilding after this economic collapse, and then suddenly realizing stage three, my God, they're being taught to kill, to do whatever they're told, and stage four, utter terror about what this means and the feeling that the rest of the world doesn't understand the gigantic evil that is blossoming here.
There was a tremendous underestimation of Hitler, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. It's interesting, when I started doing the research for the book, I thought there'd be a pretty steady progression from people understanding Hitler better and better. But in fact, I went back and for Hitlerland, I just said, I need to know, who were the first Americans who met Hitler, and what did they think of him? And in fact, the first two Americans, an American journalist, Carl von Wiegand of the Hearst Corporation, and Truman Smith, a junior military attaché in the Berlin Embassy, met him in 1922. And their descriptions, Truman Smith, for instance, kept a notebook that's available in the Hoover Archives, were pretty good, saying this is a marvelous demagogue who really knows how to rouse a crowd. He could really get a following. So in the sense of treating him seriously, at that point they were not predicting he would become the master of Germany and of all of Europe, but von Wiegand, for instance, said he might become the dictator of Bavaria, which was pretty good at the time when many people hadn't even heard of Hitler. But then later, a lot of American journalists totally underestimated it. Dorothy Thompson, who was the most famous woman foreign correspondent at the time, famously went in for an interview with Hitler in 1931, November 31, so it's about 14 months before he takes power, and wrote, "I thought I was going to visit to interview the future dictator of Germany, and within something like 30 seconds or 50 seconds, I realized I wasn't, that he was so insignificant a figure." And a lot of people thought he was looked effeminate, which meant somehow he would not be able to stand up to the more masculine German politicians, that he had these jerky motions, this bizarre behavior, he didn't look you in the eye. And there was a tremendous underestimation of him, even on the dawn, right before he takes power.
It's really amazing. I mean, these are bright people, used to talking to powerful people, and they really didn't quite get it.
Yeah, but to be fair, now many other people didn't get it either, including many Germans who were the political opposition, and including many German Jews. One of the characters in my book that I talk about is Paul Drey, a German Jew who worked in the U.S. consulate in Munich for a long time, met with the U.S. consul at the time, Robert Burphy, observed Hitler right at the beginning, kept telling his bosses, "This guy's never going to amount to anything. The German people will never go for a guy like this. He's too, he's just got a bunch of thugs, that's all." And the tragedy is that even in the 30s, once Hitler came to power, Murphy, who was already out of Germany, tried to get Drey out, offered him not only to get him out, but to get him a job somewhere else. He refused, and Drey, in fact, died in Dachau in 1938.
What was the strangest story you unearthed?
Well, the Helen Hamstangl story was certainly one of them. Another one I would say is, I tell the story, we've all heard of Charles Lindbergh and, of course, his coming to Germany and being sympathetic to Hitler in many ways or to what was going on in Germany. But what I found was an interesting story that doesn't negate that in any way, the known facts, but shows the origin of how Truman Smith, this young military attaché who later comes back to Germany in the 30s, actually is the guy who plants the idea with Hermann Göring, the air marshal, to invite Charles Lindbergh there, because Truman Smith is alarmed by the arms military buildup of the Nazis. He can't get much information on the Air Force, and he figures if Lindbergh comes there, who's the biggest celebrity of that era, Göring and the Air Force will want to show him everything to show it off, and that's what happened. And so Lindbergh actually provides some real interesting intelligence for the U.S. Whatever his motives, he may have wanted to do that in part just to tell the U.S. stay away from these guys, don't tangle with them because they're getting so powerful. But then to get to the strangest story, there's a lunch between Lindbergh for Lindbergh hosted by Göring, and at one point, Lindbergh asked Göring, I hear you've got a pet lion. Could I see it?" And sure enough, Göring takes everybody from this lavish lunch to the library. A lion cub about 4 feet long jumps into Göring's lap, and all these Americans are there, and at a certain point the lion gets nervous and relieves himself all over Goering.
He's
a big fat man in white uniform, and his uniform turns yellow. You know, you can't make this stuff up. It was, you know, amidst all the craziness, there was just insane scenes, which I think, you know, makes this a real story, a collection of stories, many of which I even as much as I read about that whole era, I had never heard of.
Fascinating. I remember there's also a great story in there about the daughter of a former American ambassador to France who notes to one of the officials there that sometimes the Nazi party rewards deserving Jews by making them honorary Aryans. And he concedes this, and then she says, well, can you tell me how I could become an honorary Jew?
Right. That was a lovely story. I was just fascinated by that. It came out in the notes of one of the junior American diplomats who was there who described this scene. There were a number of American women married to Germans, and some men, but usually women married to Germans who lived there, and some were known to be sympathetic to the Nazis or let's say apologists. But this woman not only was quite the opposite, but had the guts to say something like that. How do I become an honorary Jew? You almost wanted to stand up and applaud right there.
Yeah, just after reading it. I want to thank Andrew Nagorski for a great visit on Two Jewish. His book is called Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. Really interesting book. Thanks very much, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest. Get a final musical play out on Two Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be the top academic, Dr. Nancy K. Miller, discussing her recent book, What They Saved, Pieces of a Jewish Past. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or on our TwoJewishRadio.com website and like us on Facebook. Our playout this fine morning comes from Israeli star Ofra Chaza. It's called Rachamim. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Hello.